I've always been a hardcore feeler. So I was like super sensitive when I was a teenager, you know, just like crying over boys like every week and like writing these sad diary entries.
For many years, thousands of Nepalis have been moving overseas with the hopes of a better education, job, and lifestyle. Some find success in conventional fields, while some carve their own paths. Who is to say one is better than the other? Success is a journey, not a destination. So come on this journey with me, where we connect with our Nepali communities living overseas and explore their conventional and unconventional paths. My name is Sankalpa Gurung, and this is Hamro Yatra. And welcome to the 14th episode of Hamro Yatra. Today we have with us Nirvana Bhandari, a globetrotter, feminist writer, and activist. If you follow her on Instagram or have read her work, you will know that she is unabashedly herself. Founder of Sister Orita and F Project Nepal, Nirvana is passionate about women's empowerment. She uses her voice in inspiring and encouraging nonconformity in taboo topics such as sex, desire, and nudity. In this episode, we explore Nirvana's love of travel and the impact it has had on her life so far. We talk about the role of journaling in her writing, how she got started with her projects, and her journey with being comfortable with her truest self. As always, if you enjoy these conversations, please share with your friends and family. Remember to follow our Instagram page at hamro.yatra for updates. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Spotify and leave us a 5-star review if you're feeling generous. Hi, Nirvana. Welcome to Hamro Yatra. Thank you for giving us your time today.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. So I wanted to start with just a few icebreaker questions. Now, if you could choose any superpower, what would you pick?
Flying, that's always been the one when I've played this game in the past I've gone to, and I haven't been more creative than that. I think it would be so awesome to have wings and just be able to like take off whenever, go anywhere, come back. Yeah, I think that's awesome.
No restrictions from lockdowns.
Exactly, yeah. The best part.
And if you could pick any food for the rest of your life, like one cuisine or one dish, what would you choose?
Oh, cuisine on China. It doesn't just have to be one dish. I really like Thai food. But at the same time, I don't know if I could live the rest of my life never eating Nepali food again. Yeah. So it's difficult. But yeah, I really like Thai food.
Now, if you could go back into time and go to any like Nepali historical moment, is there anything that would fascinate you to go back into?
To be really honest, I feel like I don't know enough about the history to know when I would choose to go back. But I do like just hearing stories. So both my parents are from Kathmandu, but just hearing their stories of how beautiful Kathmandu was when they were growing up, when sitting in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and how green and lush and safe it was, definitely makes me feel like I wish I could see Kathmandu like that, because now it's just, you know, a pain in the ass. Like
it is not that anymore.
No, exactly. So I'm like, I can't even imagine. It's like this serene town. And I guess there's also a saying, right, that it's where the gods live or something. Kathmandu kuke upans at the store, about how it's so serene. So that would be cool to see that.
Yeah, I grew up in Nepal, but I think you just get used to it. So you don't really take notice of how things are until you leave and you come back and you're like, wow, things have changed.
Yeah. And every time you go back, I think even ek bar samapani, there's so many new changes. Again, you're like, oh my gosh, yeah.
Yeah. Now, before we go into your current work and what you are doing, I wanted to dive into who you were when you were growing up. Mm-hmm. So walk us through how Nirvana was as a child. What was your childhood like?
Oh, gosh. So many things. So the childhood that I cannot remember. So when I was so young enough that I don't really have a memory, that my mom and my family tells me that I was like a very, very good kid. I always ate all my food, you know, just the really typical stuff. Like I listened to what they said, but that's what they said. I always was like like a really good girl. And I guess I kind of continued on that trajectory to when I got a bit older. as a child. I was very, very good in school, like super nerdy, super studious, loved to read. So my father definitely kind of instilled that in me at a young age. So around third, fourth grade, when I really got into reading. And I remember I'd finish like one book in a week. And he, like, I loved it and became such a fast reader as well. So I'm sad that I've kind of lost that habit, because I think now there's so many distractions, Unsani. So for to even sit down and finish an entire book, like, I just find it so difficult. But yeah, I was an avid reader.
I did also read somewhere that your childhood home was in Boston.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
How did that come about?
So my mom did her master's degree in Brandeis University, which is in Boston.
Yeah.
So I grew up in Nepal till I was about seven. My mom got into this program. So my father and my mother and I moved to Boston, and we lived there for about 6-7 years.
Oh, wow. And then around the age of 16, you moved to Melbourne?
No. So then when I was 14, I moved back to Nepal for 2 years. So did 2 years of high school, class 9 or 10 Nepal, on the 11th grade. When I was 16, I moved to Australia.
Oh, okay. So like going from America to back to Nepal for a few years and then to Australia, how was that transition for you?
I really didn't want to move back to Nepal, you know, when my parents said, okay, we're moving back. I definitely had become very American in my, I think, values, ideals, because those, like, you know, main years of my childhood and identity formation was in America. So that was kind of how I felt. The thing that really surprised me was that how deeply I reconnected with my Nepali identity in those 2 years. So when I was 15, 16.
Yeah.
And it was really lovely, because I remember, like, you know, I had a proper life there. Like, I was going to school, I had Nepali friends, boyfriends, which was like really silly childhood romances.
But I think that's so important, doing like those things that you do when you're a teenager, like, you know, friends, school, boyfriends. That's all part of growing up.
Yeah, definitely. So, yeah, it was really nice. I realized how valuable that was for me and important to my, like, identity development and sense of self only when it was taken away from me, I guess. Mm-hmm. So when I moved to Australia, I was in the 11th grade, 16, and it's in that peak time of, like, adolescent angst, and everything's really difficult. So, I'm here in this foreign country again. So I had a much harder time adjusting. And I really missed home, and I missed Nepal. And I remember writing in my journal once, because I was really struggling for the first few months. And I wrote, like, why are we in a foreign land trying so hard to fit in when we just don't belong? And I really felt that way for a long time. And I think I also found Australian society very different. The culture kind of is very different from American culture as well.
Yeah.
And also is the age that I moved. So I was like, I was just couldn't relate to my peers, you know, just found everything, very foreign.
I actually studied in the States for my uni, and then I moved to Melbourne and I went to Monash for, like, my postgrad diploma. And I loved going to school in America. And I was sort of expecting the same thing back in Australia as well. Like, I just assumed a predominantly English-speaking country, you would have similar culture, but the school culture was massively different. I didn't find any school spirit. I didn't find the same kind of school culture that I was used to. And I was just so depressed, because I just thought I'd made the biggest mistake of my life. Like, why did I leave all that to come to this where I feel like I couldn't belong anyway?
I definitely understand. So I did my undergrad here. I thought, I feel like somewhere in the university promotional strategy, they really need to make it clear that there's no, like, school culture here whatsoever. Okay, it's really just go to class, go home.
Exactly.
It's such a shame. It's really a shame, because undergrad, I think it's kind of not just one university or one program, but the entire uni culture here. And it's a shame.
Ani, you did your degree in Monash as well, I know.
Yeah, I did.
And after that, working for about a few years, then you started your travel journey. You started your travel journey when you were 20 or 21?
The first trip I did alone, I was 21. And then I went on a really big trip when I was 24.
Now, what prompted you to start your solo travel at such an early age?
I actually felt it wasn't even that early looking around my like Australian peers. Okay?
True.
So I had a, so I had a best friend in uni. So when we were 19, she went off to Europe on her own for like 5 months. And when she told me that she planned to do that, I was shocked. And suddenly I was like, how did you even get this idea? Like, why would you want to? You know, I'd never heard
of this
possible. Yeah. And I just never had heard of something like that before. And then like, seeing how much fun she had and how it just like, was incredible for her. I was like, okay, well, if she can do it, you know, I can do it too. So I think that's kind of just how the idea came into my head. And I went back to America, actually, my first solo trip, because I wanted to, you know, go back to a place that was my home for many years. So I went to America and Mexico for 2.5 months. And it was amazing. It was definitely life-changing. Like, it was a solo trip. There was times I did kind of group travel within it and stayed with family, but I went and came back alone. And it was, it just was incredible and so freeing. And again, journal entries, this will be a theme in this conversation, but I was sitting on a train, really boring, let's say like Monday 12 o'clock and writing in my journal, and I was like, I've never felt so free before as I do in this moment, you know, like there's no one waiting for me, no one relying on me. I don't have to be anywhere at any time. Like, this feeling is better than anything I've felt before. So that's kind of how I fell in love with travel.
And then you mentioned that later on you did like a massive trip. Now, how did you prepare for that? Because you were gone for like almost 2 years. I know it's not cheap traveling around Europe. Even if you're backpacking, you still need to have some funds with you. Mm-hmm. What did you do to prepare for the trip?
So after the first trip that I just mentioned, I think in my head I always had like, once I finish uni and can, you know, save up quite a bit of money, I want to go for as long as I can. So I think that mentally, that preparation and excitement was probably like three and a half years. And suddenly like counting down until I could finish my undergrad, save, and then go. And it was a lot of, I think, courage building as well, because at first, obviously, it seems very daunting. And for my family, especially, because I probably would talk about it at least 2 years already. I was probably talking about it. Okay, like, for 2 years. And I said that.
Just mentally preparing them.
And I think for ages, they didn't believe it. Like, my mom especially, I think she thought it's this wild dream that she hopes to do, but she can never do. Maybe this could type. But then I was like, it's really going to happen. And then she was like, oh shit. Okay. She's really going. So she's like, 1 year, just 1 year. Okay. And now they're, you know, used to my like wanderlust gypsiness. So saving obviously was a big factor. I'm so lucky that, you know, I have an Australian passport and that I was able to work here. So once I finished uni, so I studied public health and social work. And then my first job was in a women's non-for-profit. So, you know, work that I'm really passionate about. Anitya, I worked for about a year and a half. Like, yeah, I learned so much and obviously got to save a lot as well. So took all that money in my bank account and left.
And how did you decide on which places you wanted to go to? How did you plan the trip?
So there was definitely many sneaky hours in the office when I would just not do work and just have like 7 tabs of budgeting and, you know, and sending all these blogs open, like sneakily taking notes. So yeah, I had done like an outline for the 2 years of where I wanted to go and kind of rough idea of months in each place. So I initially wanted to go like most of Europe, Middle East, and Eastern and Southern Africa. And I was planning to do a lot of volunteering as well throughout it. And then once I started, and then I guess I'd kind of, my Ramrodi plan, say probably just the first 1-2 months, which I started in Spain and Portugal. And this was, I had a rough idea that as I started, you know, moving along through those places, I was like, this is not enough time. And suddenly like things came up or you get tired as well. That's what I didn't like take into account, even though I was still like young, I was 24. I would just get so exhausted of moving through places in a few days. Just wanted to take time. Then I would, you know, fall in love or I'd find really amazing friends and new plans would come up. So this city, I didn't even cover, let's say, 1/3 of the geographical amount that I'd wanted to. So spent most of my time in Europe and Morocco.
Okay. And with the volunteering part, was that arranged beforehand, or is it just something that you found on your way and that intrigued you and you started just applying on the spot?
So Workaway is a site that's really amazing. I discovered that beforehand, and they basically have volunteering opportunities around the world. I know. So a few I had looked at before, and I'd kind of shortlisted a few places. But the rest, especially the ones I'd planned later after 1 year and stuff, few plan or similar got it, because I was like, look, it's not, you know, it's not realistic to plan it all now. I thought it in Morocco. My first volunteering thing was in Morocco. I was at an English school just helping out like with English language practice. It was very easy. I ended up having a bunch of free time because it was like a really small town in the middle of nowhere. There's nothing to do, you know? And even our work was just like 1-2 hours a day. So I had all this time. And that's when I was able to start this passion project of mine, which is called Sister Orator. And it was basically this idea I had at home before I'd left for my trip. And that was, I knew that I'd be meeting a lot of like really incredible women on my trip. And I wanted to find a way to like capture their stories and share that with the world. So I started this project in Morocco. I ended up staying 4.5 months in Morocco and traveling around the country, meeting these women from like really different walks of life, all ages, and having these conversations with them and recording that.
Wow. And I think I saw it in your Instagram as well. The story was in top 7 in the awards as well, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Like in London.
Yes. Yeah. Wow. Okay. You've done your research. Yeah. For women of the world. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's pretty impressive for something like you're traveling, you're like doing all the things that you're passionate about, and then a passion project comes up and it actually means something and it's doing well. That's amazing.
Yeah. I think I hope to pick it up again one day. Can I get oily someone say I've, let's say, gathered the stories of more than 80 women from like 4 countries. And so from Morocco, went to Turkey, Greece, Bulgaria, India. Well, that's lots of countries actually. We're really focused on it heavily in like 4 countries. So there's so much. Yeah, I learned, and it was such an incredible experience. And I really hope one day to tap back into it and like put a book together of these stories or make a short documentary or something like that. I haven't let it go fully yet. It's still there in the woodworks.
And even when you were traveling, you were still writing for a few different websites and stuff, right? Like Global Hobo was one of them. I think you started writing at Rising June Curie as well.
Yeah.
When you start writing for such publications, do you just apply for that? Or how does that work?
I don't know. I feel like things kind of come to me. I guess I put out, you know, certain intentions. I know that sounds so, I don't know, like manifestation, but I believe in it to some degree.
I believe it like 101%. I'm all about manifestation. I'm all about visualization. So you're just speaking my language.
Yeah, so I guess I just manifested it. But Rising Junkie, I can't remember how I found it. But my first piece for them was, I felt like such a perfect fit because it was about Nepali women and solitude and travel. And I don't know how I came across them, but I wrote a few things for them, and that was really amazing because I think that was years ago, but I remember that was the first hint where I saw that the Nepali community could really relate to my story, especially like Nepali young women. So that was when I first kind of picked up on that. And then Global Hobulai, funny, I think I just found out about it through a friend. I wrote one story for them, then built like a really good relationship with the editor and continued writing for them.
How long does it usually take you when you're writing these articles? Like, what's the process? Is it just like inspiration hits you when you're doing something and you start writing them?
Yeah, basically, yes. because I guess I'm quite lucky that I don't have to rely on freelance writing to make a living. You know, this is something that I love to do, but it's not what pays my bills. So that means I do have that freedom that only when I feel really passionate or compelled to write something I can. It usually is when some big event has happened internally or externally. And then I'm like, oh my God, I need to just get this all out on paper. And then it's like, bam. And sometimes it's like ghost fingers, you know, like I don't know who's writing. I'm just like typing.
Like possessed.
Yeah. And then I look back and it's like 700 words and they're beautiful. And I'm like, how did I do that? And how can I do it again? I don't know.
Do you think journaling from early ages, putting all the emotions in paper, helped you with your writing process now?
Definitely. I've always been a hardcore feeler. So I was like super sensitive when I was a teenager, you know, just like crying over boys like every week and like writing these sad diary entries. So that has worked out for me in my favor. I think writing, I've written for a very long time, like journal, so definitely I'm a big believer that the more you practice something, the better you get, because I've seen that in my own writing as well.
Now that you've traveled extensively by yourself with groups, what do you get out of travel?
I think travel, the way I travel and what I seek from it has really changed as I've gotten older. So when I was younger, I think it was very much these experiences that I really would never have had at home. You know, like I've fallen in love so hard and had the most amazing romances when I traveled, and you know, with people that I would never be able to meet anywhere else, friends as well from across the world, and just doing like crazy adventurous stuff that just makes me feel so alive. So I think at the when I was younger, it was definitely that, and I wanted more and more, and the sense of freedom that I mentioned earlier, I know, where I could just wake up and do whatever I wanted in that day, which was so addictive. It's still that's still a big part of why I keep coming back to travel, and I think I'll never really be able to like let go of that. I think that's once you experience something like that, you need, it's addictive, right? And people say that.
Yeah.
And now I think I've realized, and I've done so much solo travel, but now that I've gotten older, I really want to share that with like, you know, a really good friend or a partner. And it's so sad because I haven't had any partners who have been like, had that same wanderlust that I have, which is such a shame. Cause I'm like, you know, I just want someone and we could do all these cool things together. So I'm still on the hunt, low-key hunt for them. But yeah, I think now I really look for immersive experiences where I can learn a lot from travel. So I think having a project like Sister Orator, you know, writing or doing something with the people I meet or the cultures that I'm experiencing, that's really important to me. And I think also connecting to some sort of community within that travel as well. So I love, you know, like meeting local people and learning from them and hearing about their experiences and stuff like that. So definitely more immersive travel that keeps me somewhere for a few months, that kind of thing. That's kind of what I seek from it now.
Yeah. How has travel helped you become who you are today?
Oh, I feel like I even want to say 90% of this that you see before you is travel, but it's helped me a lot. I think confidence is a big thing that I learned in this big journey that I went on. So it ended up being about 15 months this 2016. They're this month. I mean, like, I just gained so much confidence in my own skin, in myself. I think I learned to really value, everything about me, I guess, every way. Like relationships, it's taught me a lot about kind of the type of relationships I seek and deserve as well. What really makes me feel alive, what I'm most passionate about. So it's reaffirmed all those things for me.
Yeah. When you were traveling, I guess you had Sister Orator going on. And I think towards the end, that's when F Project Nepal came into play as well. Mm-hmm. What was the process behind getting that started? How did that come about?
So last year, I was back in Nepal, so 2019, for the long, I guess about 6 months. And I hadn't spent that long in Nepal since I was, since I moved to Australia. You know? So since I was like 15, 16. That was the most amount of time I spent in Nepal as an adult. So Tio Vilama, I really started writing more about the things that I do about feminism and about my lived experiences, I guess, and sharing that on Instagram, which I'd been doing for a while. But last year, I ended up having an art exhibition in Nepal. So with my photographs and poetry, and I did a performance as well. And that was amazing. Like, I think that was such a great opportunity for me. It really opened up this artistic, you know, path and career of mine. And it was received very well. And I think that's when really people started engaging with my content a lot more on Instagram. And I was very obviously like motivated by that. And I started writing more and more. So with your exhibition, I also ran a few workshops with young women about topics like self-love, nudity, desire. On this month, I saw that how much there was this hunger, I think, of young women in Nepal to express themselves and talk about things like sex and desire and feminism and their rights and so on.
Like there was big taboo topics in our communities. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. So there was so much of that desire there, but I felt like not enough platforms that were really there that they could write about. I think feminism, Bunny, like it's one thing that really frustrates me when I go to Oileum. So now obviously everything's happening through Zoom. So these Zoom discussions and forums is that people are still stuck at the level of like, why do we have to even defend saying that we're a feminist? And so, like, what is feminism? So that's the most basic. So people are still stuck at that level of like, oh, we need to convince people that feminism is not a bad word. And it's just, and it's sad, you know, that it's still, it's still stuck at that. But I think, so for women, young women to even feel free and comfortable to express their feminism is still like, not enough spaces for that. So yeah, that's how I started the F project. And it's doing really well. I'm really happy with how it's going. So many women have been able to relate to it. We recently did an online exhibition where we got submissions from maybe 50, 60 women who send their writing and their artwork. And we've been sharing that on our page. So the core group of members is seven of us. So writers and a photographer as well. And yeah, that's been awesome. I'm really excited to get back to Nepal once Corona settles down a bit and engage them more, because we want to do like exhibitions, events, and so to make this even bigger.
You're 100% right in saying that you would think by 2020 you wouldn't have to defend being a feminist, or you wouldn't have to even talk about feminism in hush hush corners, you know. I remember when I was in Sydney and it was like my first day at work, and we had like a big team of like 20 people, and we were just talking about different things. We started talking about relationships, and I was with my partner at that time. We were talking about how we want to both take each other's names, last names. So we respect each other, so we want to share our last names. And one of the guys looked at me and he eyed me top to bottom and said, oh, you're one of those.
Oh my God.
It just took me by surprise, because I didn't expect, and he was younger than I am as well. So it's not like he's like this 60-year-old man or anything. Not that justifies anything, but like he's this young man who's like 25 years old, grown up in Sydney. And he looked at me and he said, oh, you're one of those. And I was just, I just couldn't put that together. I was just shocked, and I couldn't say anything back, because it's like, wait, what?
I think there's actually a very toxic masculinity in Australia. Like I've really noticed that in my experience as well. And that was the other thing I loved about Europe, was that I felt like men actually really saw me as equals there for the first time maybe that I'd ever experienced. I mean, the way we had conversations, you know, they really valued what I was saying. They were never trying to like talk over me, anything like that. And Australia, I might say, I do feel there is this very toxic masculinity. So I'm not super surprised that your coworker said that to you, because I think it is, they're still quite behind in their thinking in a lot of ways.
Now, just to talk more about that as well, Nirvana, how did you get into feminism and like researching about it, or taking such a big stance on like your Instagram, for example, and trying to normalize all these things that are so evident, like just human body, like, you know, how did you get started?
Oh, so many things. Okay, where shall I start? So my mom has always been a very big role model for me, and she's worked in women's rights for a long time, since I was a kid. So that was the first inspiration I think I had. Needless to say, when I was in uni, I studied social work, and my passion was always women's empowerment. So my idea was always that I'd go back to, you know, Nepal or other developing countries and work for, in women's empowerment. So that's been a goal of mine since I was very young, you know, over 10 years.
Okay.
Needless to say, I fell in love with writing more. I started writing more. Sister Orator obviously showed me this, how much I enjoyed listening to women's stories and learning from that as well. And I think, I guess, kind of, you know, marrying all those different aspects together and then into my own journey as a woman and how I became more confident and powerful, I think that was just, it was like a natural progression to lead me to where I am now, I see, and especially with my sharing. So when I first started writing kind of publicly, it was a lot about, I think, my experiences and vulnerability and emotions and things like that, you know. And Thupani, I found it a very powerful thing to do, because I was like, I don't know, I think I've been, people have said I've been, I'm too sensitive, or I have too many feelings in the past, and suddenly, like, especially partners who are just mediocre. So the stones, and so it was really freeing and empowering for me to write about all these emotions, post them on the internet, be totally vulnerable, and have people like receive that vulnerability. It was so amazing. So that really made me like, yeah, I kept writing on this petty. Yeah, I don't know. I feel like, yeah, it was like a natural progression. I feel like that's the best way to say it. And I'm very passionate about these things that I write about. Sometimes I actually like wait for trolls or for stupid people to say stupid things to me, because it gives me that like fire. Sometimes I'm just like, oh, I'm bored, like lockdown, I need a nap. And then if someone writes me like this ridiculous message, I'm like, yes, I'm ready. I'm ready to like demolish
Bring
you.
It on.
But it is a reminder, I guess. Sorry, what kind of that shows is that I do live in a very nice bubble. You know, all my friends are feminists. I have a very supportive family. So sometimes I almost forget like how bad the patriarchal world is, and how, you know, there's still women's rights are still like, just, I don't know.
There's still so much work to do.
Yeah. Yeah. So I need that reminder sometimes. So I'm like, okay, gotta get back into it.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned about the trolls, and I remember earlier this year that whole incident with the boys' locker room and the Nepali babes. And how do you take care of yourself when you've got all these people coming at you with all these different things, not just the Nepali babes incident, but just on your posts as well, right? Like, you're just trying there to voice your opinions and you do it so well, but there are those haters that come at you, and yeah, maybe there are days where you're like ready for them, but if they come at you all the time, how do you sort of put that away and not let it get to you personally? Or do you have any tricks that you take care of, how you take care of yourself?
Yeah, a few friends reached out to me and was like, they were like, I hope you're okay. I've seen these horrible messages about you. It honestly didn't even touch me. I think since my exhibition last year, because there were, you know, nude photos of me in this exhibition and stuff, and it was quite, I guess, confronting material for some people. I've been dealing with the stuff in small forms, you know, so I've definitely developed, I think, a really thick skin. That being said, you also can never fully prepare yourself to what level of violence, because this is violence, right, that someone could direct at you. So I say that now, but something might happen and I might be like, oh my god, I was not ready, because you just can't predict, and that's what violence is. Reddit was stuff, I was overwhelmed with actually how many people were reaching out, and I felt like a sense of responsibility, because I was, I guess, the first person to kind of publicly break the story online. And then that sense of responsibility that, like, okay, I need to really be doing all this stuff. So it was more just, like, very exhausting. On auto trolls, yeah, people ask me that a lot, but it's really not as bad as people might imagine. I think a lot of people are just cowards. Like, they probably talk about me behind my back or whatever, but they don't really have the guts to say it to me. People who write on my, like, stupid comments on my post, it's just ignorance, you know? So I feel like I'm not going to waste my time fighting with someone who doesn't even get what I'm trying to talk about. I really disengage. I think I find that the best, especially if I know that someone actually doesn't want to see my side of things at all, and all they really want to do is, like, attack me or try to tear me down. I just completely, like, don't even engage. And if I need to, I'll block them. I think it's really important to protect your own space. And just because you are like a public figure of some sort doesn't mean you owe anyone anything. Like, I don't have to explain myself to anyone because, you know, that my page is still my private space. So I, try to remind myself of that.
Yeah. Now, what's next for you, Nirvana? I know you're in lockdown. You've got all these plans, maybe pick up a sister orator as well, go to Nepal. Do you have anything set up for the rest of the year or next year?
Corona really messed everyone's 2020 up. It was going to be great. I can't complain. I think I've still been quite lucky this year. And I'm happy to be home at this time in Australia. I hope I'll be here the rest of the year. Still doing stuff, you know, long distance with F Project. Kalo is another gallery that I work very closely with, so it's just a really amazing initiative. So yeah, I hope to be back in Nepal early next year, and a bunch of stuff. I think once I'm there on the ground, things will just happen a lot. Be doing a lot of stuff with Kalo, organizing workshops, exhibitions, F Project Lepani. I want to grow that more. I'm writing a book as well, so I've been working on it.
Oh, that's exciting.
Yeah. So I started, and so I initially had the idea when I was traveling 4 years back, it's going to be a travel memoir of all my experiences, but now it's definitely changed form and it's more a series of personal essays. So talking a lot about my own experiences, but also really analyzing it through the lens of like feminism and kind of having a social commentary about, yeah, the things I've lived through as well. So yeah, it's pretty exciting. I think it's going to be great. I just need to finish the book.
How far along are you in the book?
It's going well. I hope, sometime next year that it will come out. Mm-hmm. But yeah, writing is not an easy process. I think most writers will, especially working on a book, I think most people will complain about that. But hopefully the wait is worth it.
How do you get yourself to really work on it? Or like, I know when you talked about your writing, you only write when you're inspired by like certain events or your own personal emotions. But when you're working on a book, do you wait for those certain events to happen to you? Or do you just lock yourself in a room and really try go at it?
I'm the worst person to give advice about this, honestly. Like, if you want to write a book, you should not ask me for advice because I'm not doing it very well.
What not to do?
I'm not very disciplined, which is very difficult if you want to finish stuff. I have written a lot of it. It's, in a way, it's kind of easy because I've been writing consistently for so many years that it is about picking little bits of what I've already had that I've experienced and kind of putting them together in a different way or then analyzing it.
Yeah. Now, one of the things with this podcast is we're trying to really explore these conventional and unconventional paths. And from what you've told us so far, like traveling and writing, doing all these different things on Instagram, it is not your conventional way of growing up, especially in a Nepali community. You mentioned that you've got your parents' support, and that's amazing because I think that's one thing that is a big blocker for a lot of us. But with the support that you have, what do you think success is?
That's a really good point about Unsani family, Nepali family pressure and expectations. I think it's so hard to break out of that. Even from me, although they're pretty supportive, there have been times when I've definitely felt pressure or that I have to prove something, and especially when I was younger. And I think once we're in that mentality, it's really hard to break out of because we never want to be a disappointment, you know, to our family, especially.
Of course.
Success for me is following your passions. And I think if I wake up every day and I feel content and fulfilled with whatever I'm doing, then that's successful, you know. I think money is only important so much as it makes other things happen, you know, not just to accumulate it. But for example, obviously for me to travel, I need to save money. So disco laggy it is, but I don't think I need a lot of money. I don't really measure the value of my life through that way. But I think really fulfilling relationships, a personal sense of satisfaction, and feeling, passionate about something that you do, and being able to grow and learn. Not every day, because that's hard.
Some days you just want to be a sloth.
Yes, it's not that easy. I don't know. I could get pretty like existential about it because what even is the point of our life? But also I think if there's two things that I need to be doing to feel successful, one is writing and one is working with supporting women in some way. I think that's all I really need. And if travel's in there and then being with like the love of my life is in there, then perfect. That's all I need.
Bonus. Now, to wrap things up, Nirvana, if you could give any advice to someone who is far away from home and like are struggling to find their path, what would you suggest?
Yeah, it's a big question. But yeah, what's worked for me is a lot of self-reflection, not neglecting your passions. You know, sometimes I feel like, especially with creativity, it is like a flame within you that can be extinguished if you don't nurture it. So it'd always be there. It'll never go away. Thought if you bury it under all these distractions, then it gets smaller and smaller. And to really let it grow, you do have to pay attention to it. So I think that is really important. And it's scary. I think creative people know that to let them, like, it's not an easy thing to be an artist. But I think it's also that if that's who you are, then you need to be making art, I know. So this is, yeah, this is something I would suggest. Ani, yeah, self-reflection. And when Corona allows travel, it's so easy to say, don't care about what other people think, just do you. But I think at the end, it does come down to that. So when I left for my trip 4 years ago, I was really worried that Nepali community in Melbourne would judge me for, you know, having had a great job and then just leaving and literally becoming like a hobo, right, for 2 years, like having no plan, just traveling. And malai manchhe so dekho pani thiyo ki like ke timi ghumi matrai rako like 2 years samma ghumeko ani aru ke garyo huncha ni, and like kasari bujhaune that travel is not ghumne huncha ni, like it was so difficult. Yeah, I was quite worried, and I was like, oh my god, you know, people probably, you know, I'm expected to work for a few years and then maybe do a master's, and the linear kind of path is do that, then have a partner, get married, buy a house, have kids, and sunny. So when I first started breaking out of that, and now I'm very much broken out of it, I think I'm just completely like a wild horse. But at the first initial stages, I was really afraid of people's reactions. But the thing was, no one actually said anything. And sunny, it was a fear, but it never actually came true, I guess, because actually so many people told me how inspired they were about my travels, and people who I really like least expected it from, like some auntie Oru, for example, in Sunny, who just like, I'm like, I mean, they're not even young women or anything, but they were just like, it's so courageous how you just went and traveled by yourself. So yeah, that was really cool to see. And now I think, yeah, I'm at a point where I've broken so much out of the mold that I could like never go back into it. And I think it's going to keep like becoming more and more of that.
Yeah. I think most of the times it's also like you grow up with the society expectations, but at one point you start putting those expectations on yourself by yourself. Does that make sense? So it's no longer the society expecting things, but you expecting things to fit into what you thought society wants.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think that's for all of us, Tata, because it's like, yeah, we ingrain what society tells us. And then to break out of that is so difficult.
Yeah.
And as I'm getting older, I'm really learning that even more and more so, that like you just cannot be listening to other people's opinions about what success looks like to them, or what they think you should be doing with your life, or that, you know, you're 30 and you're not married and you don't have like a permanent job. Oh my god, this is the stuto. You just can't entertain those dialogues. Okay, you really have to just have that like self-assurance that no, you're doing what is right for you in this moment. And that's okay, Sunny. So I think really that like accept.
That's a beautiful way to end this as well. So thank you so much for your time, Nirvana. I'm really glad that you took out time for us. We're excited to see this new book and see what your journey takes you to.
Thank you so much. It was great to talk to you.
Yeah, we do.
As always, if you enjoy these conversations, please share with your friends and family. The screenshots you've been sharing with key insights on the episodes and tagging us at hamro.yathra on Instagram truly make my day. So thank you, and keep them coming.